Representative Portman, Representative Eakins in another committee, and looks like we have a lot of testifiers, so I'd be happy to start just as soon as you're ready.
I'm sorry?
I'd be happy to start as soon as you are ready. We will not be able to add on your amendment until we get a quorum, but we could get started with the informational parts about your bill, and then...
Do we wait for a couple more members? I would like to explain my bill to the actual members of the committee.
We could adjourn into it another time.
There you go.
Captain Gold.
But we do have to, I think we're going to try and be out of here at 6 o'clock, is that right? Or we're supposed to be out of here by 6? Yeah, so we have 90 minutes and 12 testifiers. That's going to take an hour anyway. I'll tell you what, Representative Portman, we'll give it. We have Representative Druskowski. He's the lucky winner. Can we start then?
Is that a quorum, Mr.
No, it's not a quorum, but I'm with everybody running around to different rooms. I'm starting to wonder if we're not going to get enough folks. But I think we would have a hearing here to get folks on the record just so we can get going.
Sounds good. Mr. Chair.
So we can't move your bill yet, but if you wanted to just start presenting, and my understanding is we're going to, when we do get a quorum, we'll add on your delete everything amendment so that we can have an official committee engrossment, but that we're not voting on the bill today. Is that correct? Is that your
understanding? That's my plan, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Fire away.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the proposed low-carbon fuel standard is one of the recommendations of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. As you all, I'm sure, are familiar with by now, in 2007, this legislature decided that we should set some greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. And we set a goal of reducing our overall emissions 80% by 2050. What we haven't really started to do yet is take actions that would help us achieve those goals. And adopting a low-carbon fuel standard is one of the actions we can take to achieve that goal. What's important to understand about the proposed low-carbon fuel standard is we are looking at putting together a Minnesota Midwestern low-carbon fuel standard. Right now, the EPA is working on one, and California is working on one. In Minnesota, we have a different perspective and a lot more expertise on biofuels. And it is very important that we put forth a proposed low-carbon fuel standard that other states around the country can look at that is well informed by our expertise in biofuels and how they positively contribute to decrease greenhouse gas emissions. One of the most important things, and the reason I'm carrying the bill here in the Minnesota legislature this session, is that I think we need to make sure that whatever low-carbon fuel standard we adopt is fair on both sides of the ledger. You sometimes hear a discussion about the life cycle analysis of carbon emissions from a fuel. And some folks will talk about the emissions from the corn ethanol industry as being somehow related to deforestation in the Brazilian rainforest. And that is only half of the picture. On the petroleum side of the equation, there are some other externalities that also need to be taken into effect if we're going to look at the life cycle emissions for a fuel. The carbon input in an aircraft carrier that helps our troops in Iraq. The carbon emitted in shipping our troops to Iraq. The carbon emitted in putting together the AK-47 that they hold in their hands over there in Iraq. I think if we're going to start trying to incorporate indirect carbon emissions, it's very important from our perspective that it be incorporated on both sides of the ledger. Since we really can't come to any mathematical degree of certainty about those kinds of carbon emissions, they should not be taken into account on either the ethanol side of the equation or on the petroleum side of the equation. With that sort of overview, I would like to present my testifiers, who will give a little bit more detail about what the low carbon fuel standard is and how it would work in Minnesota. I just hope that committee members will remember that the objective is that we articulate a standard that's consistent with Minnesota values and our expertise. We're not copying anybody else's low carbon fuel standards. This is about creating our own.
I might interrupt. I'm not an expert, but I think that the AK-47 is actually a Russian weapon, and so wouldn't be in our arsenal, I think, in the United States. But. Okay, if you could state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Could you indicate, what would be the American version then?
M16,
okay, I'd say. Okay, thank you. M16, I will begin speaking about carbon emissions affiliated with production of M16. Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant with the Isaac Walton League. And what I'd like to do is, first of all, walk through the bill with you and give you a sense of what the bill would actually accomplish, and then talk about a couple of the issues that have come to our attention as we've been working on this issue over the course of the session so far, some of the things that I think are important to clarify about what the bill does and doesn't do. So let me start with the bill itself, beginning with some of the definitions contained here. And one important concept is on line 1.8, and that's the concept of carbon intensity. And what we're trying to do is influence the carbon intensity of transportation fuels sold in Minnesota. And as you can see here, what that means is that the quantity of carbon dioxide that is being released per unit of transportation fuel sold is calculated on a life cycle basis. And what we mean by that is we're not just looking at the carbon emissions at the point of their release from the tailpipe. We're going all the way back to the very beginning in terms of how the fuel was extracted from the ground, if that was the case, grown, what have you, all the way to the point where it's entering the fuel supply chain. So that's an important first concept. A second important concept is on 1.12. This is the notion that Representative Portman was just referring to, indirect carbon input. What this means is looking at all of the, not just the direct life cycle impact associated with a particular fuel, but also any indirect effects that are important and might be significant to the value that we would assign a particular fuel type in terms of its carbon intensity. And she gave the example on the biofuel side. There's a raging debate going on about the notion of indirect land use change, that being the at least the theory that if an acre of corn is put into production in Minnesota for fuel rather than for food, then the world food market still needs that acre of corn. And so somewhere else, an acre of rainforest perhaps, falls to make way for that new acre of corn that the food market needs. And it's been postulated that indirect land use will have a big impact on the value that we would assign for carbon intensity for ethanol. There's a great deal of debate about that, and we're going to get into how the bill treats that issue in a moment. We also define here what renewable transportation fuel producers are, and we distinguish transportation fuel producers from those that produce renewable transportation fuels. The former become what we call, in Subdivision 8, responsible parties.
Sorry, I have to interrupt for a second. I was just going to call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Why don't you go ahead, and when we're finished, we'll do the minutes and the DE amendment.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I should clarify that I'm working off the delete all version of the bill. I hope that's what you have in front of you, not the bill as introduced. A responsible party in this case is anyone who produces, blends, or imports transportation fuel for sale into the state. That is, as a practical matter, for the most part, refineries that refine petroleum products in the state. Those are the ones that are given the responsibility in this bill. for achieving compliance with the low carbon fuel standard. And we also clarify then on 2.4 on the next page that a responsible party does not include retailers or renewable transportation fuel producers. And so we exclude as responsible parties small gas stations and others that provide gasoline at retail to the extent that some of them receive product directly from another state. We didn't want to confuse their obligation with the obligation of the larger refineries. And renewable transportation fuel producers are those ethanol and biodiesel producers providing the lower carbon fuels that allow for compliance with this requirement. Then Section 2 describes what the actual reduction standard is under the bill, and what it suggests is that beginning in 2011 through 2020, we ask responsible parties to reduce the overall carbon intensity of fuels 1% per year. And we, beginning on lines 2.23, suggest some of the ways in which we expect responsible parties to comply, primarily by blending lower carbon transportation fuels, biofuels for the most part, with their higher carbon fuels to achieve the standard. They could also, though, change their own production processes and extraction methods and achieve efficiencies there that would have the effect of lowering the life cycle carbon intensity of their fuel. So there are more than one way to comply with the standard. We also then, beginning on subdivision 2 at the bottom of the page, offer flexibility in the way that the standard is met and give parties the ability to petition the commissioner, who is the Commissioner of Commerce, by the way, with a change in the schedule that might be needed for various reasons. And then beginning at the top of the next page are a series of three what we'll call off-ramps. In the event that these conditions would apply, the commissioner is authorized to delay the schedule so that the condition would have a chance to resolve itself. As an example, the state is going to be applying for a waiver to go from E10 to E20, and that's a significant thing in terms of achieving compliance with the standard. And if for whatever reason we weren't able to get E20 approved by the federal government, that would force us to have to reevaluate whether or not the 10% standard was achievable in the time frame that we were suggesting here or not. Beginning on line 3.8, we set in place carbon intensity values for the major transportation fuels serving the state. And you can see that gas, it's all pegged to gasoline with a 1.0, and you can see how the rest of the major fuels serving the state play out from there, with corn ethanol, that's either natural gas or coal-fired, getting a 0.77, but you can see how much better you do if you change your production process and instead fire your ethanol plant with biomass, as some ethanol producers in the state are beginning to do, and you achieve a much lower carbon intensity value. Beginning on subdivision 4, there's a way for anyone affected by the bill to petition the commissioner to suggest that the carbon intensity value that we assign in these default values, that their particular fuel is actually better than that, and to present evidence to the commissioner to make that case. And again, we think that there are going to be instances where some of our biofuels producers who are making innovations in their production process or in the feedstock that they're using could achieve a lower value through this section. Subdivision 5, this is where we address the indirect effects question. We've talked about all of the direct life cycle impacts, and those are incorporated in these default carbon intensity values. But there is an approach here, or there is There are issues that I've mentioned before that are that indirectly affect these carbon intensity values, but we don't think that the science is fully resolved on these questions yet. And so what this section does is basically create a two-year waiting period for the science to kind of settle out before we would take any action to revise any of the numbers that are on the previous page. And that section, by the way, was came after a lot of conversation with some of the agricultural interests in the state who have an obvious concern about indirect effects and what they might mean for the values assigned to biofuels. There's a reporting requirement, and that's, I think, fairly straightforward, and a compliance and penalty provision for failure to meet the standard. So that, in a nutshell, is the bill itself. What I wanted to do next, before taking any questions, was to just raise a couple of the issues that have kind of come to us as we've been working on the bill. The most significant of those has been the concern about what the job impact of this particular bill would be. And we've heard in previous testimony in the Senate a fair amount of concern about what the impacts would be at local refineries. And I want to make it very clear that what we're talking about here is not affecting the quantity of biofuels or other alternative fuels that our refineries might be required to use. Those limits are set by the federal government. We're already at the maximum blending rate for ethanol and for biodiesel in the state, and any decision to increase that would have to be approved through a waiver process with the Environmental Protection Agency. And as part of that waiver process, EPA will evaluate whether or not operating vehicles, existing vehicles, at higher blend rates is damaging to vehicles or not. And if they find that it is, the waiver will not be granted. But being the state that we are, and the fact that we've been very aggressive in the area of requiring higher blends of ethanol and biodiesel, I expect that Minnesota will always be at the maximum blending rate allowed by the federal government. And so we're not doing anything to affect that. What we're doing with this bill is affecting the quality of the fuels that we're substituting for petroleum, and doing that by driving innovation in the biofuel sector. That is really the thrust of the bill. Second issue I wanted to address is the jobs issue. And it's closely related to this issue about how much of a blend rate is going to be required. We do expect, if we go to higher blend rates, and studies are bearing this out, that we will see job creation in Minnesota. A recent study looked at the impact of going from E10 to E15 and found that over 3,000 new jobs would be created in Minnesota as a result of that move. And in addition to that, $586 million would be invested in the ethanol plants that are being used, that are creating that ethanol so that they can expand their capacity. You know, we think that it's clear that this bill, if it has a jobs effect at all, is going to have a positive jobs impact, not a negative jobs impact. Going from E10 to E15 is a 50% increase in the production capacity required to meet that. Minnesota already ranked fourth in the nation in ethanol production capacity, with 837 million gallons being produced per year. I mentioned before that Minnesota has requested or will request a waiver to go to E20 so that the jobs statistics that I just gave you, I think, are probably conservative in terms of what we might see in Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take any questions that committee members might have.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Representative Portman, I was just going to maybe suggest that Mr. Anofsky wants to go, and then we get the pro people all together, and then members can put questions. But first, I have to do a little housekeeping here. We do have a quorum now. And members, if you came in late, Representative Horstman has a DE1 amendment, which would put the bill in the shape that she would like it. And that way we'll have an official engrossment, and then I believe we're laying the bill over. But we wanted to have the official engrossment. Representative Junkie, would you, if you don't mind moving the DE1 amendment?
I will.
Great. Representative Junkie moves the DE1 amendment to House File 86. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Okay, the DE1 amendment is adopted. If we could just do the minutes quick, Representative Saylor, do you mind moving the minutes for April 2nd? Excellent. Representative Saylor moves the minutes to be approved for April 2nd. Any questions on the minutes? There are any questions on the minutes? Good deal. Okay. All those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Okay. Mr. Anofsky, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name and organization for the record, please. Oh, Representative McNamara.
I have a question for Mr. Grant.
Sure. Do you mind if we get the pro folks done, and then you can bombard them with all the questions you want? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Don Arnowski. I represent the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Mr. Grant went through the bill, and I appreciate that, and covered most of the important issues. The only other thing that I'd like to put in front of you is what we believe this to be, as Mr. Grant pointed out, is very much a supportive engine of change to assist in the evolution and the development of our existing strong renewable fuels industry. As you note in the bill, the default value determined by Argonne National Laboratory using widely accepted methodology is recognizing that as a corn ethanol facility moves off of what you might call traditional fuel sources of either coal or natural gas to biomass power, in this case biomass fired using a gasifier, there's a substantial reduction in the total carbon inherent in that fuel and that fuel production process. That is one example of the kind of innovation that is accessible today, where investments have already been made by several plants in Minnesota. I would point out particularly for you three of our locally owned Minnesota ethanol plants, Winnebago Corn Plus, that for example is 40% wind powered for their electrical needs, and 60% biomass powered because they utilize a byproduct of their own processing to generate the process heat for themselves. So they've already taken some investments at Corn Plus that improve their efficiency, reduce the amount of carbon necessary, the fossil carbon necessary to produce their product, and in many instances they're making these investments because they believe it circulates the money among their membership. Many of these are cooperatively owned, farmer-owned facilities, and they appreciate shopping among themselves rather than exporting dollars to fossil fuel providers from out of the region. I would also point out for you the Chippewa Valley Ethanol Company in Benson, Minnesota, which has made an investment in a gasifier, and they're using wood chips and corn cobs to provide ultimately 95% of their process heat. Right now they're in the ramp-up stage of bringing that technology online. And then the Little Falls plant, Central Minnesota Ethanol Cooperative, which has also put a gasifier in place, and they've been using wood chips for that, and they formed a partnership with another company that is proposing to use wood and potentially other cellulosic materials produced by farmers, such as grasses and corn stover, to produce the first cellulosic ethanol in Minnesota, that so-called Holy Grail, where we use a different feedstock, such as agricultural or forest waste material, to produce liquid fuel. The point of all this is we have a number of our facilities already beginning to make the innovations that are necessary, that would be encouraged, sheltered, and indeed rewarded under a policy like this. So we very much believe that this kind of policy will keep Minnesota in the forefront of an emerging and evolving and improving renewable fuels industry. And we think, as 20 years ago when Minnesota took the first steps into renewable fuels, once again we're in a position to lead protecting our rural communities, our rural jobs, and in this case, our global climate as well.
Thank you, Mr. Arnasi. Any questions for either Mr. Arnasi or Mr. Grant? Representative Horstman.
Mr. Chair, we do have one more testifier in favor of the bill, but for the many members who were late and missed my pro-ethanol rant, or for those who are also not on the Transportation Policy Committee in 2005 and got to hear my pro-ethanol rant, I would just like to repeat, so those of you who are hearing this bill for the first time understand why it is we're proposing a low-carbon fuel standard in Minnesota, and that we are not proposing to copy anybody else's low-carbon fuel standard. What we're proposing to do is put in place a model low-carbon fuel standard that states around the country, as they look to adopting a low-carbon fuel standard, can look to a state that's an expert in biofuels and say, that's the one I want to copy. I don't like what the EPA is doing. I don't like what California is doing, but Minnesota got it right. They got it right with E10, they got it right with E20, and they got it right with their low-carbon fuel policy. And so the reason why we are working on this bill here in Minnesota is we are the nation's experts in biofuel policy. And it's important that when we look at adopting a low-carbon fuel policy, that we treat both sides of the ledger fairly, the biofuel side of the ledger and the petroleum side of the ledger. And if somebody wants to say that we're going to incorporate into a carbon intensity number the proposed deforestation of the Brazilian rainforest, we are also going to incorporate in the petroleum carbon intensity number the amount of carbon that's input in manufacturing an aircraft carrier, an F-22, an F-15, or an M-16. So, with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce Jerry Seck.
Mr. Seck, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jerry Seck. I'm with a law firm called Fleckenhoff and Daly Lindgren, and we represent many clients, including the Minnesota Ethanol Coalition. The Ethanol Coalition is taking no position on this bill, but one of our members, Bill Leaf, who runs the Chippewa Valley Ethanol Plant in Benson, called me from Atlanta and said he couldn't be here as he had planned to, and asked, he put a letter on his BlackBerry up to us and wanted to have us read that on the, to the committee, which we agreed to do so. I'd like to have Karen Holt read the letter because, number one, most of you know that she can read better than I. She's a Fulbright scholar in Norway for 3 years, and I've had her cover about 50 hearings and hasn't had a chance to testify. Because she's in Norway and speaks fluent Norwegian, Mr. Eakin, and she told me your name translates into oak tree, she'd be glad to read the letter in English and translate to Norwegian if you so desire.
That would be great. So, actually, it started out as birch tree, but as you said, since I became a chair, now I'm oak tree. So that's and Ms. Holt, welcome.
Hi, my name is Karen Holt, and I'm here from Larkin Hoffman on behalf of the Chippewa Valley Ethanol Company located in Benson, Minnesota. I'm about to read a statement from Bill Lee, and it starts as such. On behalf of the employees and members of the Chippewa Valley Ethanol Company, I wish to make the following supporting comments on the Delete All Amendment to House File 86. We have been following the developments of this bill in parallel efforts in California and at the federal level. In general, we are encouraged that these policies recognize that biofuels derived from corn deserve the same incentives and rewards when they deliver comparable environmental benefits. Unfortunately, the effort in California has become highly politicized, and the current approach is discriminatory against Midwestern corn ethanol in favor of California ethanol, Brazilian ethanol, and even petroleum. This amendment contains many features that we like, making it potentially the least discriminatory and most truly performance-based low-carbon fuel standard in development. It recognizes the need for inclusion of indirect land use impacts, but plans to address them with an objective, science-based approach. This low-carbon fuel standard addresses a discriminatory feature of the California approach, in that it considers direct and indirect impacts from all components in transportation fuels, not just biofuels. It provides individual fuel producers the opportunity to petition for different carbon intensity values based on its ability to demonstrate higher performance. policy such as this has tremendous potential to incent the continued evolution of the state's corn ethanol industry while encouraging the development of a cellulose-based biofuel industry. We support this amendment to House File 86.
Thank you, Ms. Holt. Now, if you could say it in Norwegian.
I'll say it to you.
Thank you. Any questions at all for the testifiers so far? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Grant. Mr. Grant, you talked about new jobs in the industry, and I'm wondering, would those new jobs be at either of the two refineries that are near my district?
Good Chairman and Representative McNamara, I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, to the extent that the two refineries in your area are going to have to begin looking at how they source their ethanol supplies and make sure that they're taking ethanol from superior producers, I think it's certainly possible that there would be jobs added. What I have more difficulty with is seeing how jobs would be in fact lost.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in fact, I think there is a way that jobs could be increased at the plants, because one of the ways that Flint Hills could establish a lower carbon intensity for gasoline would be to improve the processing at their facility. So to the extent they invest in additional build-outs that make their plant more efficient, that would be more building jobs.
And Representative Anderson, or Representative McNamara, follow-up.
A quick follow-up, so I understand, Representative Hortman. It's your anticipation that Marathon and Flint Hills would actually gain jobs if this bill became law?
And Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I do believe that that's a possibility if they undertake improvements to their facility to make the facility more efficient. In addition, I mean, when you look at the demand curve for transportation fuels over the coming years, they'll be growing jobs regardless of what we do with this bill.
And Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This question is for Mr. Grant. Your testimony, maybe I heard wrong or misunderstood you, but did you say that for every acre of corn grown in this country for ethanol production, we take an acre of rainforest out in Brazil?
Mr. Grant.
Chairman and Representative, I said that theory has been put forward by some scientists who have looked at the question of what happens when you have a very tight market for food and you convert some of the food that's being developed, some of the acreage for food now, and convert it to fuel. I don't personally accept the argument that that's what's going on. However, there is enough debate about this in the scientific community right now that we didn't feel that it was appropriate to simply ignore it as a possibility. We don't think that the science is settled in this arena yet, and that's why we've created a process for letting the science further develop before we make any changes to the values that you see in the bill.
Mr. Chair and Representative, not to single you out, because you weren't the only one who was late, but you missed the part where I indicated that's the reason we're doing a low-carbon fuel standard in Minnesota, is we reject that argument made by others in other parts of the country, whether it's at the federal level or in California. And if we don't have a low-carbon fuel standard that doesn't see an acre of cornfield in Minnesota as being traded for an acre of Brazilian rainforest, we run the risk of having a standard like that imposed on us.
Okay, any other questions before we move on? Okay, seeing none, I guess we'll move on to the other testifiers. Thank you, Mr. Grant, Ms. Holt, Mr. Anasi, thank you very much. And let's see, next we have Ms. Diane Schmidt, Coke and Coke Companies. Welcome, Ms. Schmidt. And if you could state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Schmidt, my Vice President of Coke Companies, and I've also got with me today Jay Reinhart from Flint Hills, and we've also invited Doug Manley to join us right now. He's an employee also with Flint Hills here today representing the steelworkers union out at our plant. I'm also here today representing Flint Hills, which is one of the Koch subsidiaries. Thank you very much for allowing us to testify today on this particular piece of legislation. In the interest of time, we have prepared remarks which we have put into your record, but I will just hit some of the highlights of our remarks so we have time for other people's testimony as well today. Also in your packet today, you will find a map illustrating the workings of the Minnesota crude supply and how we get our crude supply into Minnesota. There's also a chart in your packet that illustrates the life cycle estimates of well-to-wheel analysis that shows the carbon intensity of certain crude supplies that we utilize in Minnesota as well as the rest of the country. And then also to hit on Representative McNamara's question that was just asked of the author, a letter that was written to the Senate Energy Committee that specifically outlined our concerns relative to job losses as it relates to this legislation. And you will see our extensive concern relative to job losses as we see this legislation going forward. And you can take a look at that legislation, and they're happy to answer any questions. I'll go through that in my testimony, but I also have Jay Reinhardt here, who is the author of that letter, who can specifically outline our concerns relative to job losses and why we think that is such a concern. And I'd also be happy to answer and specifically the particular question about why we do not believe that we could take efficiencies at the refineries as a way to add additional jobs at the refinery. We've already taken all of the efficiencies that we feel would be able to be taken in that regard relative to this legislation, and in fact, we will hit on some of those topics in my remarks. Also, please note that our testimony was written before we actually got the delete all amendments, so I'm going to hit some of our major points as they relate to low-carbon fuel standards and what our concerns are. And then at the end of my testimony, I will hit some addendum points with the time we've had so far to go through the delete all over the last several hours. And we'll go through those points as we have been able to take a look at them today. First of all, some background on Flint Hills Resources. Flint Hills Resources operates a Pine Bend refinery in Rosemont, Minnesota, also named for Grove Heights. The refinery has been in operation since the early 50s, and at that point it was a 25,000-barrel refinery. Today it's a world-class refinery that produces about 3,000 barrels a day of product. We provide much of the gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel that helps power this region, and we are by far the largest purchaser of biofuels. Currently we blend at E10 in anticipation of blending at E20. We also blend B2, and we'll be in the next several weeks be blending B5. We'll be going with a straight B5 with all of our product, so we'll be anticipating that here in the next couple of weeks. We currently employ 850 full-time employees and between 200 and 2,000 contractors at our facility. We are the largest continuous construction project in Minnesota. We just recently completed a $350 million project. Just to put that in perspective, that's like building a new Twins baseball stadium. This was to produce an ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel production facility. To put in context, since 2002, we've spent over $3 billion in construction projects at our facility. In the last 10 years, we've reduced our emissions by 50%. Of the 50 largest refineries in the United States, ours ranks number 7th as the lowest in air emissions per barrel. Last year, our air emissions were 68% lower than the industry average. So we've done what we can to try to be a good corporate citizen, both from trying to bring jobs to the community as well as trying to do well by the environment at our facility. Our position on the bill is that we have very serious concerns with the bill as well as in the delete all amendment that we've just recently been able to take a look at. Our concerns stem around several major points. One is that we believe it'll increase the price of gasoline at the pump and will create a less stable fuel supply for Minnesotans. We believe it will create job losses for our employees at the refinery, as we will be forced to scale back production in order to meet this standard. We believe the bill could have the effect of increasing our use of crude oil from places other than North American sources, like Canada and the United States, and increase our reliability on Middle Eastern crude. We also believe that Minnesota's actions could lead to a net increase in global greenhouse gas emissions of Canada. Canadian crude is currently being used is displaced in Minnesota and has to go to China and in India, this Canadian crude will be used somewhere. And if it's not used in the United States because of the life cycle analysis, which is really the crux of the matter on this, which is that if we go through a low-carbon fuel standard, which is really what has been mirrored in California, and even though there's been discussion and efforts to try to take that out of the bill, we believe that there's still, in the way it's been drafted, and even in the way that the delete all has been drafted, if there's anything in this bill that makes it less attractive for us or for others to use Canadian crude, you are going to very much destabilize this market, you're going to reduce jobs in this market, and you're going to make it very, very difficult for people in the United States to use Canadian crude, thereby leaving us the only choice to use Middle Eastern crude. That would be a very bad thing for the United States. First of all, we'll have to buy crude from unstable governments. It'll be much more expensive for us to do that. And if we are not able to use Canadian crude, there's really no reason for us to have this refinery in Minnesota, because the whole reason that the refineries in the upper Midwest have been placed here is because of our proximity to Canadian crude. We recently just completed an over $300 million pipeline expansion to bring Canadian crude to this area. It services both our refinery and Marathon Asset. I know they're going to come up and speak in a minute. But I think that even though there have been efforts in both the Senate and the House for these amendments to try to deal with that issue, if this issue is not resolved, as it was not in California, there will be significant, significant impacts on our region and our refinery and our ability to continue operating in this state. Another reason that the low-carbon fuel standard is extremely important for us as a business right now, if we plan very long-term on our facilities and how we are going to invest in the state, we long-range plan and making our investments in hundreds of millions of dollar increments. How can a fuel producer like ourselves, when you have legislation like this out there, when we have to plan for things like this, make a long-term plan? When we're dealing with science that is not settled, when you're talking about the vagueness of some of the stuff that is in this legislation, how can we adequately plan as a business for the future? And I think that's a long-term concern of ours. Even in California, where they've had such an enormous amount of time studying this, an enormous amount of money, they have still not figured out how to implement a low-carbon fuel standard. We are just at the infancy of looking at it here. If you look at even the carbon intensity value section of this particular legislation, it's baffling. And I know Mr. Reinhart can take a stab at this as well. We're really still puzzled at exactly how we got to these numbers. There's some new numbers that were put in here. I know it's based on the Argonne study and some other things that we can address, but it's still very puzzling to us exactly how we got to these and how we would implement it. So there's just a lot of things, and we can talk about this. A lot of this is in my written remarks. But in closing, on this particular portion, I think it's just important for the committee to understand that if we don't have Canadian crude, our refinery wouldn't be here. I mean, that's the whole reason that we're here. So if there's anything that would destabilize this in legislation, it would make it very difficult for us to move forward and for us to expand or continue the same operations that we have in Minnesota. We cannot say for sure exactly how this legislation would affect us, but I think it certainly is going to require a lot of study, and so we would need to make sure that we would not work in haste and go forward with anything without taking a long, strong look at this. Jobs are at risk, our business is at risk, and we think it's very important for this committee and others to understand that. To be clear, however, I think it's important that we have the committee understand that we very much value the environment and our commitment to Minnesota to the environment. We've spent a lot of money at our refinery and through our employees trying to make sure that we do right by the environment. And our opposition to this bill should not be taken in any way, shape, or form as anything less than a commitment to the environment. We just think it's extremely important that the committee understand what some of the unintended consequences of this bill could have. I'll just touch very briefly on some of the things that we find concerning in the delete all amendments. First of all, as I mentioned, the carbon intensity value section, we think, Jay, I'll just give him a second, a minute to talk about that. I think there's some really strong concerns about that. The indirect land use, subdivision 5, the question of unsettled science regarding land use, holds before any indirect land use or indirect carbon inputs can be incorporated into the carbon intensity. The commissioner must include any estimates of indirect land use change unless there's a broad academic and political consensus. I mean, it's extremely vague about how we're gonna get to that. This provision seems to lay groundwork for discriminating against certain fuels while protecting others on the basis of land use. If Canadian crude is not the target of legislation, then the same protection should be given to all. I mean, if you're going to be giving certain protections to biofuel-based products, then we think you should be giving them to all. I mean, it just seems like there's certain benefits given to certain types of fuel and not to others. So it doesn't seem like all of the various types of fuel that are produced in Minnesota are given the same type of benefits. The policy vagueness could freeze investment at Pine Bend. We've talked about that before. The amendment establishes a series of off-ramps, basically for E20. While these are well-meaning, they are very vague, and I think that we would certainly need to work on the language about exactly what we mean by these. Probably the most disturbing single provision in the delete-all is subdivision 7. Allowing the Commissioner of Commerce to fine a responsible party, which is us. Really, if you look at this, the entire responsible party of this entire legislation is refiners. Pretty much everyone else has been taken out of any responsibility in this bill. A refiner to be fined an unspecified amount for failing to comply with this standard. I don't know how you expect a refiner or somebody like us to go forward with really an undefined amount of a penalty. I mean, you're really asking someone to go into business with an undefined penalty. Is that a year's profit? Is that your entire investment? What is that? I mean, that's extremely vague and obviously would be very concerning for anybody that's in business. In closing, I just want to say, and then we'll stand for questions for Mr. Reinhart and then Mr. Manley. The amendment does little to ease our concern. From our standpoint, we are still being asked to use a fuel that doesn't exist. We're being told to measure our success against a carbon model that is unsettled and being threatened with fines of unknown amount for failing at something we have virtually no control over. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. And one question that I have, and maybe you can make it clear, because I'm having troubles understanding why it would make Canadian crude less attractive. For one thing, looking at the intensity values, it doesn't distinguish between Canadian crude or Mideast crude. And it seems to me that if you did do a study to look at the full costs associated with acquiring the crude and the carbon intensity, it seems to me that it would make the Canadian crude even more attractive in that, as you had said, there are a lot of problems with the Mideast crude as far as the instability, the military infrastructure that's necessary to maintain access to that Mideast crude. The fact that you have existing infrastructure coming in from Canada as well, that's already there, that's already in place. You made a good argument about, that crude would go elsewhere. I think that would be something that I would think would be taken into consideration as well. So I just wanted to, I guess, get your take again on why it would make Canadian crude less attractive.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, well, there are several reasons. First of all, I think whenever you're talking about, and I think even Mr. Grant talked about extraction methods as part of his testimony, which is still meaning that they're talking about extraction methods, which is a real, enormous part of about Canadian crude, which is then Canadian crude is more carbon intensive because of the way in which it's extracted. So if you still have the proponents of the bill talking about extraction methods, it's still on their mind, which was, even in California when they talked about Canadian crude not being treated differently, it was in the end. And so we're still quite suspicious of the fact that that is still being a large driver. Also, you're still talking about life cycle analysis, even in the delete all amendment. And so you're still talking about the fact that the Commissioner of Commerce is given wide discretion to change the carbon intensity values, which are still going to be subject to the legislation. So you still have proponents that are going to be able to go in and change the carbon values. So once these are set by the legislature, doesn't mean that it's done. So even if we were to pass legislation, one of the only significant ways in which you're going to be able to change the carbon intensity of fuel is through something like the carbon intensity of the fuel in its extraction. If you look at one of the handouts that was in the materials that we provided to you, it's this life cycle analysis sheet. If you look at the variables that are involved, one of the only variables in the crude life cycle estimates is really the production element. And if you look at that is really one of the only ways, because really refining is pretty standard, fuel combustion is pretty standard, and so really when you're talking about it, there's going to be very few variables to really lower the carbon intensity of fuels. Right now, it's one of the only variables other than biofuels, which will be maxed out at a certain level. There's only, let's say you get to 20%. Let's say that we are able to get a waiver and you're at 20%. That's going to be maxed out. Right now, most refiners, like ourselves, have already done most of the major projects that you can do at a refinery to, lower your carbon intensity at your refinery. We've replaced all of the equipment because it makes good sense. We replace our equipment because we become more energy efficient, which means we save more money. So we're already at the point where we're almost as carbon efficient as we can be at our facilities, and we already get rebates from Excel if we're carbon efficient. So if you look at it, there's very few ways in which we can be carbon efficient with fuel, because if you look at it, crude oil is carbon intensive. It's carbon. Petroleum is carbon. We're not like electricity where you have lots of alternatives. Crude oil doesn't have a lot of, it's not like we have natural gas or things, right? I mean, there are no replacements other than some biofuels that are available. There aren't any replacements readily available for petroleum. We don't have wind. We don't have hydrogen. We don't have a lot of things like that's why transportation isn't as far along in this whole debate. There's just nothing to replace it with. And so what you're doing is you're making policy that you're asking people to rely on. Well, we don't have a replacement. And you're risking huge multi-million, multi-billion dollar investments that people have come in and made based on hoping that there's going to be an alternative by the time 10 years rolls around, or once we reach the maximum that the government will let us use on ethanol. And so it's obviously a very scary proposition for us when you don't have a replacement option.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you. Mr. Chairperson, thank you for doing an informational hearing on this. And Representative Portman, I appreciate you bringing the bill forward for a discussion on this. I'm also interested in the next testifiers, of course, because it's from my district of in 57A, which is Marathon. But I'm going to ask you a question. Do you have any interest in investment interest in biofuels? Does your company own any investment in biofuels?
Ms. Smith.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our company has actually a separate company that does all kinds of research in investment into alternatives, and we've actually purchased companies to look at all kinds of varieties of investments, whether it's hydrogen or biofuels or other things. Currently, we do not own any biofuels companies. Jay, I don't know if you have any additional information in that regard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We currently do not have any investments in the biofuels space that you were talking about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are the single largest purchaser, however, of biofuels.
Okay. And maybe we could move on to Mr. Reinhardt if you want to continue with the testimony. If you could state your name for the record.
My name is Jay Reinhardt. I'm the Director of Operations for Flint Hills Resources. I appreciate the chance to testify today. I guess the thing that I'd like to comment on is two core areas. First of all, there's been a lot of discussion up here about the jobs that are available within our company relative to this this policy. And what I would tell you is there's three core reasons why jobs will be lost at Flint Hills Resources if this bill is passed. The first one is the open-endedness that this leads to disadvantaged Canadian crude versus other crudes or versus other transportation pathways produced transportation fuels. If that has a chance to reduce fuels, that cuts production at our facility. If we cut production, that has a chance to reduce jobs. The second area is if you look at it from a pure blending opportunity, if we have limited limited ways at the refinery on which we can reduce our carbon footprint, which almost by definition, with no credit trading in this bill, it essentially forces us to blend biofuels. When we then blend biofuels, that replaces a barrel of product that we make into the market. But that again, once again, leads to a production cut, which then can lead to reduction jobs. And then finally, I think more importantly, and this is where the true jobs are and the money that we spent, Ms. Schmidt mentioned the billions of dollars that we have spent here in the last 5 to 10 years, and really over the last 50 years, and really the focus of the last 10 years here, is this uncertainty that this creates, the demand destruction that it creates for petroleum in the marketplace. All the millions of dollars that we spend to do projects out at the refinery, we just can't invest in an uncertain marketplace or an uncertain environment that way. And because of that, net-net, this bill reduces the jobs at Flint Hills Resources. Second comment I'd like to make, too, is, you know, we talk a lot about the uncertainty of science. One of the things that really needs to be expanded on as we begin to study and learn these things. I think there's a significant uncertainty around how we define the carbon intensity associated with the bill. One of the things I think that would be beneficial to everybody involved is to get better documentation of where those numbers came from, what is the technical basis of it, what studies are they based upon, and where does it come from. Right now, we take at face value where these numbers come from with really no reference except to a GREET model, but what is the study, where does it come from, and what are these bases? Because I think the leap of faith that we talk about the Brazilian rainforest with, I think we're taking a leap of faith with these numbers unless we can soundly understand the technical feasibility associated with these carbon intensity numbers.
And thank you, Mr. Reinhardt. Any questions before we move on? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Reinhardt, I'm trying to understand. You're saying there's a correlation that if we restrict the possibility of Canadian crude, there might be a correlation to that and the $1 billion you've spent at the refinery and the thousands of people you've employed. Some of them, I've had some of my constituents say they've had years where they've made $100,000 working at the refinery because they work in the turnaround and work some 12, 14-hour days continuous. Are you telling me there might be a correlation between those kind of jobs and this bill that would allow to potentially limit the amount of Canadian crude that would go to Marathon and to Flint Hills?
Yes,
Mr. Reinhardt.
Representative McNamara, Mr. Chair, yes, that's a direct correlation. You know, if you look at the reduction or potential reduction in Canadian crude, the direct reduction of biofuels replacing our product one-to-one, that limits production. And then on top of it, if you're looking at the capital investments that we make during these turnarounds and that time, and that when we do that, that has a direct correlation to the jobs at Flint Hills Resources.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Is it true, I'm trying to remember, I've only been in the legislature 7 years, but I thought I remember when you proposed the expansion that we're pretty well through now, I believe, mm-hmm. that at one time it was talked about that it would be the largest private construction project ever undertaken in the state of Minnesota's history, and I believe there was a number of $300 to $400 million thrown around. Did that actually happen, and how much government money was involved in that job production bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we will get to those exact numbers because I think we have those written down. Megan maybe has those for us. But, yes, the expansion did go forward. There was absolutely no state or federal money involved. It was all private money. And we will get the committee. We have a breakdown over the last, I think, 5 years of all of the direct investments and the number of jobs correlated to those investments. I think that we have for the committee. We can pass those out.
Any other questions? Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that this question actually is for Ms. Schmidt, but either of you, I guess, could answer, depending on who it's for. But I'm, you know, just thinking, going back to some comments that you made, Ms. Schmidt, about your company having purchased companies so that you could do research into hydro and biofuels. Could you tell us anything about the speed and progress at which that research is being conducted?
Ms. Schmidt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor. The company is called Koch Genesis, and it is a privately held company that is part of Koch Industries. And what we do is we go out into the marketplace and sometimes purchase companies that are already doing some technical work. Of course, because that's a proprietary company, I can't go into details about that particular research at this committee. I'd be happy to come in to your office and have a private conversation about that, but I can't really speak about those details in a public setting.
Any other? Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schmidt, I was amazed at the impact that this could have on your business. You talked about over $3 billion spent for compliance since 2002, which is an amazing number. And this would certainly cost more in compliance the way it seems. The term was used. Use demand destruction, and Mr. Reinhart mentioned that. I found that a very proper term. It seems that this bill would destroy the demand for the products that you folks make. Given the fact that if this legislation comes into place, what would this mean specifically for your business? Ms. Schmidt, you talked a little bit about, you know, we have uncertainty as to whether or not we're going to be around anymore or going to be able to be around. I'm looking at the sheet here, and you're talking about 850 to full-time employees and up to 2,000 contractors, 200 others, 3,000 jobs. And then back to Representative Saylor's question about your investment in research in alternatives. What would that mean for your ability to continue that type of research that I would guess has probably not been brought on by government oversight and regulation?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, well, certainly it's always hard to estimate, you know, what legislation could do. And so I don't want to be telling the committee that we're going to go away tomorrow or, you know, incite anything of that nature, because obviously we've been a going concern for a long time. So I don't want to say that. But I will tell you that when legislation of this nature is taken seriously and moved forward, it puts a very chilling effect on a company's ability and desire to invest in a state. And it's a real concern to our company. I will tell you that since I've worked for the company for 11 years, this has been the most seriously debated piece of legislation that our company has ever discussed. It's caused a tremendous amount of concern. Clearly, as this legislation continues to be discussed, there will be concerns at the upper echelons of our company, because this truly takes away the value creation strategy, which means the whole reason that we located our business in the state of Minnesota, which was to create our company in a proximity to the source of Canadian crude. And also, being that Minnesota is not exactly the cheapest state to do business in, you have to always wonder why people want to continue to do invest here. And we have great employees. We have great educational system in Minnesota. We have a great proximity to Canadian crude. We also have very stringent environmental standards and a lot of regulation, which we are happy to follow because we think it's a great state to do business in. But as regulation of this nature, which would basically take away the whole value for our business to be located here, it certainly doesn't make sense to continue to invest or to bring additional businesses to the state. So we certainly have to look at legislation like this very seriously and to consider it as we move forward. And so I think it's incumbent upon us and others to let your committee know that we are taking this legislation very seriously.
And we do have one more question here, and then I'd like to continue moving on because we do have several other testifiers, and we do need to give this room up at 6:30, I believe. We have another committee that's moving in at that time. Representative Loon has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just asked to Ms. Smith or the other testifiers. You mentioned that I think your business or refineries are ranked seventh in the nation in terms of your operations and sort of clean technology. Mm-hmm. Would you say that the others that are ranked, one through six, is it really the source of their crude? Is it technology? Is it combination thereof? What makes up the difference for those other six?
Mr. Reinhart.
Mr. Chair, I believe I'm going to let Jay, do you have a better?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not completely aware of who the other six is, but I think we can definitely best try to understand what they are. And just off the top of my head, I'm not quite sure that I can answer that question, but I think we can find that better information.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is research that comes off of a national ranking, and I'm not positive that we know who the other six are because sometimes they don't identify, they just give you your ranking, but we will do our utmost to give you the name of those six if they are available. Otherwise, we will give you the study that that information came from.
Okay. Representative Loon.
I think, Mr. Chair, just quick follow. Can you tell me quickly who does those rankings? Is it an Environmental Protection Agency or someone else? Or
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jake, do you know where that number came from? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am told by our staff that that's a federal ranking, and we will get you a copy of that report.
Okay. Thank you. So, one more. Representative Biskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on another question. I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schmidt, in the folks who were the pro testifiers earlier, I heard what I thought is some creativity in defining what appears to be very much a big government compliance described as innovation. My understanding of innovation is that it happens in an environment that is free and includes a free market and the pursuit of profit and improvement in our well-being for society. I'd be interested to hear what you think about that and what you think that this type of legislation might have on the ability of companies like yours to innovate.
Ms. Smith.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our company is founded on the principles of market-based management, so I think that's kind of a softball to us. Obviously, we are strong believers in the market system, so we believe programs work best when the market plays the most important part for businesses to be able to be innovative on their own right and have the least amount of government interference. So I would just say that that's our basic company principle.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Doug, is it Manley?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doug Manley. I am an hourly employee at Plainfield Resources, but I'm here representing United Steelworkers Local 662. We have over 500 members that work at the refinery. I'd also like to recognize Charlie Olson, another United Steelworker member in the gallery from the range. If I could read my letter, please. Our membership in USW Local 662 does not support this legislation. This bill will ultimately constrict or totally ban Canadian crude oil from tar sands. Canadian crude oil is the stuff that gives us our jobs, our competitive advantage in the marketplace, and the stuff that gives Minnesotans the ability to use their cars, trucks, buses, jet planes, and trains in a manner they so choose. It may be imported from Canada, but it is from a source that is stable and friendly and affordable. The refinery could be forced to ship crude oil from overseas, from areas like Saudi Arabia or the like. Does that make sense? The Canadians are not OPEC. It is written in the bill in so many words. It is not written in the bill in so many words, but the legislation gives broad rulemaking authority to the commissioner of the MPCA. Section 2, subdivision 3, line 3.2 to 3.27 suggests that the commissioner would have discretion in defining alternative carbon intensity values, which would be used to assign oil sands crude oil a punitive rating, as they have done in California. California only relies on 1% of their crude oil supply from Canada, tar sands. Minnesota is over 80%, a huge amount of difference. This is not California. A number of Minnesota's top environmental organizations have also clearly stated their intent to use this legislation to reduce Minnesota's use of crude oil from Canada. House Bill 86 provides the opportunity to eventually shut the door on oil sands crude, which is something all Minnesotans should be concerned about. This bill can be seen as an attempt of the corn and cellulosic ethanol producers and biodiesel supporters to unfairly hinder oil refiners because of unsupported claims of carbon intensity values in regard to their products. A University of Minnesota study that came out in February has substantiated that. I've heard that corn ethanol is not as green as it was once thought, but rather just as carbon intensive as many other oil refining processes. If this legislation is enacted, there's no way to estimate the cost of good-paying, family-supporting, tax-paying jobs. The cost of this bill will be passed on to the taxpayer, who can ill afford any more burdens on their already strained to the maximum family budget. This bill will cause increasing fuel costs, loss, or unusable infrastructure in refining and pipeline facilities, not just Flint Hills and Marathon. The cost would certainly be in the billions, if not tens of billions, of unrecoverable dollars. This bill would expose Minnesota to even more price fluctuations due to supply and demand in other parts of the country. It would definitely put all Minnesotans at a disadvantage at the pump and the marketplace. If the whole marketplace does not adopt carbon taxes, it would make no sense to put Minnesota and her citizens and companies at a disadvantage. This is not the right bill. Our United Steelworkers Local 662 firmly opposes this bill in any form. This bill cannot be made better with amendments or deletions. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for your testimony. Questions? It's Mr. Manley. Any questions? Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I believe we've got three testifiers all together here, the folks from Marathon and API. Could state your name and organization for the record, that'd be great.
My name is Richard Kudansky. I represent Marathon Petroleum Company. I have with me Mr. Ray Brooks, also representing Marathon Petroleum Company and one of our partners.
Please pleasure with Teamsters Local 120.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing us to speak today. We know that we're on a limited time schedule, so we will try to be thorough but brief with our remarks with respect to the other testifiers coming along behind us. A little background on our company. Marathon Petroleum Company is heavily invested in refining, transportation, and the marketing of petroleum products in Minnesota and throughout the Midwest and Southeast. You may know we operate a oil refinery and terminal facility in St. Paul Park, Minnesota, a little ways southeast of the Beltway. That facility has been in its current location for over 70 years. Our St. Paul Park refinery produces 74,000 barrels per day of petroleum products. We employ over 400 people at this refinery, and at any given point in 2009, over 210 contractors are usually on site. Mr. Brooks is the manager of that facility, and as such, he's probably about the best subject matter expert in the state on the production of motor fuels. In addition to our refinery in St. Paul Park, Marathon has pipeline interests throughout Minnesota. We supply over 150 independently owned and operated Marathon gas stations retailing under the Marathon brand throughout the state. We also own and operate 160 Super America stations, with 48 more of them franchised by individual local community businessmen. Overall, Marathon employs more than 3,000 people in the state of Minnesota. Very quickly, a couple of comments on our record on biofuels and renewable fuels, because we're very proud of it. Marathon is one of the largest blenders of ethanol and biodiesel in the nation. Last year in Minnesota alone, Marathon used approximately 60.5 million gallons of ethanol and 3.4 million gallons of biodiesel to blend with our fuel. It is important to note that Marathon blends system-wide, even in states where it is not required of us to do so. Specific to Minnesota, however, we have invested millions of dollars into upgrading our Minnesota terminal infrastructure in St. Paul Park to accommodate the marketing of renewables within the last 4 years, and we will continue to do so in upcoming years as Minnesota's use of ethanol and biodiesel increases. We also have interest in two ethanol plants, one in Ohio, another one in Indiana, as well as a partnership agreement with Mascoma Corporation, a leading biofuel development firm specializing in cellulosic ethanol production. Overall, Marathon is very, very proud of its commitment to renewable fuels. Specifically to House File 86, while the goals of the bill are commendable, after a considered review, Marathon opposes the proposal. We share the tremendous amount of concern already expressed by our competitors across the river, Flint Hills Resources. Marathon today has no technology available at our plant to allow our facility to meet the carbon intensity reductions as set forth in the proposal. Nor do we foresee any technological means to do so by way of either science or engineering in the near future. If the technology were available tomorrow, there is insufficient time between rule finalization and implementation to allow for the necessary infrastructure development that would be required in any case. We also share the belief that House File 86 has the potential to unnecessarily complicate fuel distribution in the state and would seriously threaten an effective response to supply disruption. This legislation will undoubtedly, from our point of view, result in increased consumer costs and the creation of boutique fuels specific only to Minnesota. It would no doubt significantly impact economies of scale from our current production model and therefore eventually surface to consumers at the pump. Our recommendation for both Minnesota and the Midwest is to delay adoption of any state or region-specific fuel standards until after Congress has set about defining a comprehensive climate change program for the nation. Creating a patchwork regulatory environment across the Midwest will only result in higher consumer costs, further economic difficulties, and threaten jobs. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Brooks, who's got some specific comments with regard to the operation of our facility in St. Paul Park and the impact that House File 86 may have.
Hi, I'm Ray Brooks. I'm the plant manager for the St. Paul Park Refinery, and I've been in this capacity for about 2.5 years. I don't have any prepared remarks, so I may sound a little rougher than the previous speakers, but the main thing that I want to comment on in this bill is regarding the technical feasibility of the bill. As it's defined as carbon intensity index, carbon intensity, gasoline is assigned 1.0 and diesel is assigned 0.99. And there's a comment that the responsible party, which would be us, contains production process, extraction methods, or other activities to reduce the carbon intensity. That's not feasible. Every process that we have in the refinery starts with carbon and ends with carbon and either produces and transportation fuels one of two things, gasoline or diesel. And we have about a dozen processes in the refinery. You may have heard of things like cat cracking, reforming, alkylation. Essentially, they do result in different types of gasoline blend stocks, but they all contain carbon. Now, we've done a lot of projects over the years to take the bad things in gasoline out, take the sulfur out, take the olefins out, take benzene out, to make clean burning fuels. The one thing that we can't do is take carbon out, and we wouldn't want to take carbon out because it's the actual thing in the fuel that makes the engine work. So that's a real important thing for us. So it's not really an issue at the refinery as far as being more efficient or improvement. We do that every day to use less energy to make our operation more efficient. But at the end of the day, we produce gasoline and diesel, which by definition gives us a carbon index of 1.0 and 0.99. The other thing that I'd like to mention is we're a little bit unique in the Twin Cities as far as the refinery, in that our refinery produces about 2.5 million gallons a day of gasoline and diesel, but 75% of our production is sold right in the Twin Cities. We are really a Twin Cities supplier for gasoline and diesel. We don't export a lot from pipelines from the refinery, so anything that reduces the output from our refinery, we really don't have another option of where to send it to. So in that respect, it's you know, when we talk about jobs and the threat to jobs, it's very real and it's very important to us. The other thing is, from an investment side, there have been some questions asked to previous testimony about investment in the future. I can tell you my refinery right now has a $50 million expansion that has been put on hold to expand our crude unit at the refinery, and it's basically been put on hold and won't be refunded until we really know what the supply situation in the state of Minnesota is. So, you know, when we talk about the economics of future job creation and so forth, this is a real example. We've got a project that's on hold, and it's significant for us. Not the magnitude of some of the numbers you've heard before, but it is a significant expansion. It's a significant job impact for us. At the end of the day, as Rick said, we have about 400 employees at the refinery, and my biggest interest is making sure that those employees, their jobs stay secure, and they're good paying jobs, and that's the main interest for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with all due respect, we'd like to have our partner have an opportunity to speak here, and then the three of us would be open to any questions.
Great, thank you. If you could say your name again. I know you're from the Teamsters, but I didn't get your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Reese Ledger. I'm with Teamsters Local 120. We're the largest Teamster local union in the state of Minnesota, and the fifth largest in North America. In the interest of time, I'll be brief. Teamsters Local 120 understands the balance that must be struck between economic and environmental considerations. However, there's a difference between job creation projections and real jobs that employ real workers and support real families. We have 178 real Teamsters that work at Marathon. And in these very difficult economic times, we ask you to be acutely sensitive to them keeping their jobs. Thank you very much.
Just Richard and Big Evans, the question before that, just out of curiosity, we've heard this steel workers and then the Teamsters, and I see some pipe fitters. At your site, are they all Teamsters, or is it all differentiated by...
The 178 workers that he referred to are all Teamsters 120 employees.
Okay, so everybody at your plant is Teamsters?
Yes, all the hourly people.
Okay. Representative Bigham had a question.
Thank you. And of those 400 employees, one is one of my very favorite people, my father, who has been there for 35 years. So, I have worked there in the summers when I was a college intern. So I really do appreciate, and I walked the line with the Teamsters 120 about 3 years ago during a strike. So I really appreciate the folks from Marathon coming down here and testifying. One thing I wanted to point out, which is why I asked about the previous testifier about the investment in biofuels, members of the committee, I think if time allows during the interim, and I know Representative McNamara would, it's probably the closest to my district, if people wanted to come and visit the refinery, I think it would be a good tour if we wanted to go and visit and see how they do things there. But one thing that I, especially Representative Portman, if you wanted to come to, I mean, maybe we can go to Tanucci's for lunch or something right there. But my point is that I hope we can use the expertise of the testifiers to come to some sort of agreement or working together to do this, because I do appreciate the goals of this bill. But I also understand the concerns of our reality for folks. So I really would appreciate the continued dialogue between Mr. Brooks and the chief author, and I would be more than happy to join in on that conversation. But I think the expertise of especially Mr. Brooks is a good good use of our time here to answer questions and to ask how this would impact.
Representative Bingham is a tough negotiator, I can tell you. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to differ with my seatmate. I'm very troubled by this bill. I absolutely am not glad it's here. I don't want to talk about going to dinner at Tanucci. I want to talk about your $50 million expansion that's on hold. We should be killing this bill today. This is unfortunate and really unfair. The two biggest things we got going around here are the refineries. We're talking about killing them because of some national program we should have or whatever. No, you guys get, well, how much of your crew, what percentage, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, what percentage of your crew at Marathon is either Canadian or North Dakota?
Right now, we're bringing 100% of our crude down from the Minnesota pipeline, and that's a combination of crude that's sourced from Canada, either the Canadian oil sands or heavy Canadian crude, or crude that's coming over from North Dakota. So essentially right now 100% of our crude comes from the north.
If I can, Mr. Chair, and sir, do you have the ability to turn a valve and instead of bringing it from the north, bring it from the south and from New Orleans?
There is limited pipeline capacity to bring crude from the south. When I say south, up from the Texas Gulf ability, but nowhere near what the capacity of Marathon and the Flint Hills refinery is. It's just a fraction of that capacity.
Representative Stern.
Thank you, Chair. I just was wondering, Mr. Brooks, is that the $50 million expanse, is that shovel ready?
Is it what?
Is it shovel ready?
Is it ready to go?
Ready to go with
Well, what we've done is we've essentially done what we call park the project, which is complete the engineering. We've had some construction that's off-site of the refinery that we're completing that and storing material and just waiting to see how everything shakes out and see if we can get the project sanctioned again.
All right. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Brooks, when you said the project was on hold, I heard you say it was you're waiting to see what the demand situation was like. Is that what you meant? Or?
Well, I guess that's a couple things. When I say demand situation, supply and demand, and from the standpoint of what we produce from the refinery with the expansion and the impact of things that will impact demand, what this bill essentially does is it reduces demand for what we produce.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To testifiers, whoever would want to answer, I guess, do you envision that the General Motors electric car they're putting on the market next year is going to impact demand for your product?
Well, I mean, directionally, any electrical car reduces the need for petroleum-based fuel.
Okay.
You agree?
Yeah, I mean, speaking candidly, we don't necessarily, as a result of the electric cars, anticipate any reduced demand for our products next year.
We do have six more testifiers on the list, and we do need to forfeit the room eventually. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more thing. Mr. Brooks, in for the sake of time, kind of in a short or brief way, can you maybe talk a little bit about what the refinery has done to reduce carbon? You've done some improvements and put some equipment in recently that maybe has done this. Briefly, can you maybe tell the committee what you've done because for addressing these concerns and kind of how your refinery is ahead of the curve a little bit on this?
Okay. First thing, as far as provisions for making clean fuels, when I say clean fuels, that's ultra-low sulfur diesel, less than 15 parts per million diesel, and ultra-low sulfur gasoline. We've made the investments in the refinery to produce 100% of clean fuels. A couple things that we did last year that were significant, not so much for fuel, but from a just from an overall environmental standpoint, is we retrofitted one of our units, the cat cracker, with about a $20 million retrofit to reduce the particulate matter from the emissions. And that was an extremely successful project. And we also did about a $10 million modification of our wastewater treatment plant to reduce benzene emissions from the facility. So, you know, we have a history of clean fuels investments and then investments not directly with fuel but with the emissions from our operation that we've made. Did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
Very good. Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
See, I had I've seen him many times, but I haven't pronounced his name right. Daryl, is it Bungie from API?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, too, I just wanted to note there will be a point in time where I have to leave, but I'm hoping to have an opportunity to address some of the misstatements that were made about my bill before I do leave. So when you see a page coming and telling me I need to go, if you could give me an opportunity to.
Oh, very good. If you could state your name and your affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Daryl Bungie, and I'm here today representing the American Petroleum Institute. It's a national trade association representing over 200 companies involved in every aspect of the petroleum industry. You've heard from the two Minnesota refiners so far, and I would echo everything they've said to date with regard to this bill. In addition, we have some members that maybe aren't as large, but they're located throughout the country and in Minnesota. We have a refinery in Superior, Wisconsin that supplies much of northern Minnesota. We have a major pipeline that's undergoing a very substantial upgrade and increase in capacity that flows from the Canadian border through Clearbrook to Duluth, through Wisconsin, and into Illinois. This bill is really directed at a source of a very important source of Midwest, not just Minnesota, crude oil. There have been major refinery upgrades and expansions in the Illinois, Indiana area to accommodate Canadian crude. There have been similar expansions and upgrades in the Detroit area to accommodate Canadian crude. The pipeline expansion that I spoke of in northern Minnesota is also designed with the intent of moving that Canadian crude not only to Minnesota but to other refineries throughout the Midwest. We think that global climate change is a national, and really an international problem, but one that's better solved on a national basis. And we believe that the federal government is moving towards that end with legislation they passed in 2007. Mr. Chairman, I intend to be brief, so with that, I would stand for any questions.
Thanks very much. Questions for Mr. Bungie? You didn't travel from D.C., right? You're local.
No, I'm here.
Okay. So you don't feel bad that we don't have a lot of questions. Okay. Well, thanks very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hartman.
I have to go at this point, but I did want to just take a moment and respond to some of the misstatements. There's a reason we're doing an informational hearing and we're not trying to pass this bill. And the reason for that is clearly the bill is a large policy change for the state of Minnesota, very similar to the decision we made with E10 and E20 and our renewable energy portfolio standards, which took 7 years to put into place. But sometimes when people oppose legislation, they create a straw man so they can knock that straw man down. And in this case, what you're hearing, and I think Representative McNamara has been hearing from people, is that there's something in the bill that prohibits us from using tar sands oil in Minnesota. And I would just ask you to find the words in the bill that have anything to do with Canadian tar sands. Gasoline is a 1.00. 1.00 equals 1.00 equals 1.00, whether it's sweet crude from Saudi Arabia, whether it's from Venezuela, or whether it's from Canada. So there's nothing in the bill that currently prohibits tar sands or that's planning to prohibit tar sands in the future. And in fact, I think that Representative Gardner made a number of statements. We've already invested in that pipeline. That's the closest thing for us when you look at the transport expenses and the national security issues of bringing Middle Eastern oil here instead of Canadian tar sands oil. Nobody's talking about doing that, and that's not a win on any carbon mass. And then I think there's three questions that members really should have asked the refiners. And the questions are, did you support or oppose E10? Did you support or oppose E20? And how many jobs have you gained or lost since the E10 mandate went into place? Because we heard these exact same arguments when this state was the national leader on the E10 policy, that hundreds of jobs would be lost at the refineries. In fact, the opposite has been true because the demand for petroleum has increased over time. Specifically with regard to the $50 million project at Marathon Oil, we all know that the U.S. economy has been in free fall since at least September of 2008. There are a lot of businesses and a lot of people who aren't doing expansions that they would have been doing before the bottom fell out of the market in September 2008. We saw a startling thing happen in this country, which was the demand for gasoline dropped when gasoline hit $4 a gallon. So there's a lot of factors at play into whether Marathon Oil decides to make a $50 million investment or not. And there will always be legislation under consideration at the Minnesota Capitol, whether it's this year or next year or the legislature after. But market forces are going to be the number one determination in the credit markets and what goes forward and what doesn't go forward, and the American consumer's demand for oil. So I apologize that I can't stay for more of this. I understood that we were going to be giving equal time to both sides, and we're far past that equal time mark, but I do have another place that I need to be. So thank you for your consideration. So, and I do look forward to working with everybody in the interim on the bill, especially Representative McNamara, who believes maybe he found the tar sands reference in the bill.
Representative McNamara, I did have you on the list. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. To Representative Hortman, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, I'm encouraged what you're saying about Canadian crude. Would I be fair to assume that you're open to an amendment to exempt Canadian crude from the bill?
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, of course not. The point is to blend that nice, convenient, easy-to-access Canadian crude with better and better feedstock. Just like we created a guaranteed market for ethanol when we passed the E10 mandate in Minnesota, this is about creating a market over time for cleaner and cleaner biofuels, which is, I believe, why you heard the Chippewa Valley owner testify in support of the bill. He's a cutting-edge technology, and we want to encourage cutting-edge technologies like his and also the transition to cellulosic. I think we all agree that down the road we would like to see cellulosic taking up more of the ethanol market than corn. And this provides a guaranteed stream of income to people who would take that investment decision and go forward with cellulosic.
Just a clarification.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, Representative Anderson and I have about the same amount of good hearing, and so I think I had to use Representative Hackbart for my interpreter. Was after a course, was the word not, or you did say you would be willing?
Of course not.
Thank you.
Have it on tape, everyone. So thank you, Representative Hortman. I have Stephen Rush from Holiday Company. And again, we do have to be out of here as soon as we can. There's another group coming in at 6:30. If you could state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Very good, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify this evening. My name is Steve Rush. I'm the Director of Corporate Compliance for Holiday Company. We're a privately held Bloomington, Minnesota-based company doing business in the state for over 80 years. We have many units in the Twin Cities area, but many of our important units are also in outstate Minnesota outside of the Twin Cities area. And in total, we employ approximately 3,200 Minnesotans. I'm here to testify as a retailer. All the discussion upstream, I'm not here to address. I'm not an expert in it, certainly. But as a retailer, as Holiday, we have very, very serious concerns about House File 86
for one simple reason. We think this is going to hurt our customers, resulting in higher prices and supply shortages, and the consumers of the state don't need that. So accordingly, we most respectfully oppose this legislation. House File 86 will turn Minnesota, as it has been described by people more eloquent than myself, into an energy island, isolating our fuel supply and resulting in supply shortages and the higher prices that I've alluded to. None of the states surrounding Minnesota will have a similar energy mandate, meaning that Minnesota is on its own in having compliant energy products. I heard reference to making us an example, but if we're an example and no one follows, then we can have some serious problems relative to energy source as well as price. Shortages can certainly occur when you have a boutique fuel. We are exposing consumers to supply shortages in the event, for example, if a refinery has to cease production due to maintenance or some damages at the refinery itself. We can have fuel shortages and long lines at the pump that you've seen in the Gulf states after a natural disaster has occurred, or California, when one of its refineries or one or more of its refineries go down for a period of time. And you can't bring in these kind of unique fuels very easily. I know Mr. Brooks from Marathon, and he's far more knowledgeable on this than I, was referring to an incapacity to bring product in from the South. And I think that's absolutely right. I know of no practical way to bring in large sources of fuel supply from the South if we have any downtime here in Minnesota at either Flint Hills or Marathon. And trucking and fuel would be completely impractical. There's no way that we could bring in enough fuel over our interstate highways to possibly meet consumer demand. Another supply shortage problem with this legislation is, am I supposed to do as a retailer for our stations where we pull product from out of state? I still read this legislation as requiring that any fuel brought into this state be compliant with its mandate. We have any number of units, for example, in the Duluth market. We don't get our fuel from the Twin Cities. We pull it from Murphy across the river in Wisconsin. We wouldn't be able to do that under this legislation. And are we supposed to run trucks up from the Twin Cities to supply Duluth? The other examples would include Fargo and Grand Forks. We pull supply from those areas to supply our stores in that part of the state. Sioux Falls supplies petroleum products for our units in the southwestern part of Minnesota. And Mason City, Iowa, helps us supply units located in the southern part of the state. The legislation as written would absolutely prohibit us from doing that. So all we have are two refineries in the state of Minnesota, and we're supposed to truck product from those two all over the state. The supply shortages can obviously result in higher fuel prices, less product, the higher the prices are naturally going to be. There really is no incentive for anyone outside of the state to comply with a low-carbon fuel standard. We have no other options other than the two refineries that we have in the state, and ultimately that will result in higher fuel prices. Now, I know...
If I could ask you to wrap it up so we can get the other testifiers in before we have to vacate the room.
Absolutely. Now, I know that certain exceptions are provided in the bill, but those require the Commissioner of Commerce to approve it. Otherwise, we're going to have to get into litigation, which could be very protracted. And finally, Mr. Grant also said that retailers are exempt. They're not. If you're a retailer and you bring fuel into the state or you store it, then you are covered by the standard, and we have absolutely no means to comply with a low-carbon fuel standard. In the interest of moving on, I do want to economize your time. We believe the passage of this legislation will harm the consumers of the state, and we respectfully oppose it. Thank you again for allowing me to testify, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Well, thanks very much. Any questions? Well, thanks very much for coming down. I have John Hausladen from the Minnesota Trucking Association. Maybe if I could have Mr. Quilis, he would be next. If you want to stick close. But if you could state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Hausladen, and I'm president of the Minnesota Trucking Association. We do oppose this bill, and I just want to talk about one area that has not been addressed yet today. As you know, trucking is an interstate industry. We don't just travel from block to block or county to county, but we go from state to state. And frankly, consistency is the biggest issue we have, because the engines
and the trucks and the fuel and the filters have all changed dramatically. Because today's truck is really a fine-tuned system. And so when you think about it, you have the fuel that goes in, you have the activity that happens in the cylinder, and then you have all the filters you put on the backside. And so we're constantly trying to find the sweet spot to say, okay, how do you get maximum power? How do you get maximum fuel efficiency? How do you reduce emissions and do all that? Well, it because you assume uniformity and consistency. Our concern about this bill is if Minnesota establishes its own, and I want to stress own, fuel standard, we now have a boutique fuel. And if all states start doing their own thing, this consistency we need to get the best fuel mileage, to drive the less miles, to be the most efficient with everything, we have major problems. So in summary, we would like to say that we think a better solution is a single national uniform diesel fuel standard, and interstate industry needs that, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Any questions for Mr. Houseblatt? Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Quiles from the...
Mr. Chairman, Tony Quiles from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I, along with Mike Robertson, represent the Chamber on Environmental Issues before the legislature. Thank you for the opportunity today to speak on House File 86. One of the benefits of being one of the last, if not the last, is I've been able to take the red pen to most of my comments, not to reiterate what everybody else has said before me. But the Minnesota Chamber has serious concerns about the low-carbon fuel standards set forth in House File 86. Those concerns are, we believe the legislation as proposed could adversely impact our state's economy by potentially increasing fuel prices and destabilizing our fuel supply, and therefore would likely fail to achieve its overall goal, which is to lower greenhouse gas emissions. Our main concern, though, is about the Minnesota economy and Minnesota jobs. Most businesses in the state rely on the transportation sector to ship and receive products. This bill could potentially increase those costs at a time when our economy is in a recession. We've been saying for several years that the legislature should not make a decision on a cap and trade program until a thorough analysis is done on the economic impact of such a program. We take the same position on a low carbon fuel standard. Mr. Chairman, we're concerned of the impact of this legislation on the Minnesota economy. What would the environmental and land use impacts be? And more importantly, will jobs be lost or will jobs be created? In fact, it is my understanding that there is a University of Minnesota study now underway to answer these exact questions. Additionally, legislation is currently proposed to allow the Legislative Energy Commission to study a proposed low-carbon fuel standard. Therefore, Mr. Chairman, we believe it would be ill-advised for the legislature to consider this proposal before the results and conclusions of such studies are completed.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Any questions? Actually, I have three labor folks, Mr. Crimmins, Mr. Melander, and Mr. Gertesmeyer. I know sometimes you guys are all on the same page, sometimes not. I don't know if you all want to come down together, and then we'll get Mr. Staden in for the last word. And the more concise, the better.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I am employed by the St. Paul Building Trades Council as its executive secretary. Our organization represents 12,000 unionized men and women in the construction industry, and at any one time, 1,200 of them may be working at our partner's facility, FHR. My comments to today will be in support of our partner's position, Flint Hills Resources. Flint Hills Resources is a valued partner to the construction industry and to our community, providing a steady flow of fuel for the Midwest, and as mentioned in, earlier, something that the other parts of the country did not have recently. But from a more self-serving personal position, it's about the thousands of jobs that FHR has provided at any one time over the last 15 to 20 years. Not only does the FHR, our partners, provide union wages to those workers, but also the ripple effect by the benefits that are provided to those members and their family members. With construction unemployment surpassing 30%, obviously job stabilization, job creation, and job preservation is very important to us. We need to maintain this employment at this time, more so than ever before. As stated earlier, FHR has provided the longest and largest construction project in the state of Minnesota at any one time, and has continued to do so. Within the next couple of weeks, we'll have 1,200 people working at that project, providing wages and benefits for those individuals. We are supportive and concerned for an ongoing threat to our environment. The building trades members and their families are supportive of a practical legislation that will work towards emission reductions without the loss of jobs. This legislation goes way too far at the time, and we encourage our elected officials to have a reasonable debate with our oil-producing partners to have a sensible and reasonable discussion in regards to this process. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Mr. Crimmins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Carl Crimmins. I'm the president of the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association. I represent the union pipe fitters, plumbers, sprinkler fitters, and gas fitters in the state of Minnesota. And I'll be brief, but labor and management has always worked seamlessly together at Flint Hills and has been able to enjoy ongoing job opportunities while the refinery has had the resources of highly skilled, environmentally trained workers who perform their craft in a safety-conscious, flawless, and efficient manner. Now, in St. Paul, the pipe fitters right now have approximately 15% unemployment. The plumbers in the metro area are at 30% unemployment, and we're 50% underemployed. That means a lot of our workers are doing 2 days and 3 days a week just to keep their jobs. Last year, from the December labor management report from Flint Hills, there was 619,000 hours worked by the pipe fitters, which equates to almost 300 full-time jobs for 1 year. And for all the other crafts on just the construction project at Flint Hills was 1,883,000 hours, which equates to over 900 jobs in 1 year at Flint Hills on their construction project, including maintenance. Now, these are hours that were decided, again, with a labor management study. We always have good relationships with the people there. And right now, currently, there's a turnaround at Flint Hills. April and May is the turnaround. We have 300 pipe fitters working there now. They will be working 10 to 12-hour days. And, again, there's 200 on the bench right now just in St. Paul that are looking for work. And anytime somebody says that there could be a job loss, there might be a job loss, there might be a job gain, we take great concern about that. This is not a time for us to lose one more job. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. And I'll get Mr. Gertzmeyer and then Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Gertzmeyer. I work for Teamsters Joint Council 32, who represents Teamsters Minnesota, Iowa, North, and South Dakota. I talked a lot about jobs tonight. I want to take you up to the other end of the pipeline and talk about some jobs. At a January 21st hearing in the Senate on Senate File 13, David LeBoard, an officer of Teamsters Local 346 out of Duluth, Minnesota, testified in opposition to that bill. Local 346 has members who work on a pipeline construction all over the upper Midwest. They feel that if the intent of House File 86 is to restrict or reduce tar sand oil from coming into the United States, this would be bad. They felt by adopting these standards, they might lose many jobs within the state of Minnesota and potentially lose construction work. Murphy Oil Refinery in Superior, Wisconsin, has held discussions recently on a $10 billion expansion. This would result in a considerable amount of good construction jobs and would be manned from the Duke Superior trade area. There's a lot of discussion about this bill. We all realize that we have to take care of the air and the water for our grandkids and everybody else, that it can't be done at the expense of good jobs. It has to be in conjunction with them. It does no good if we don't have livable wage jobs and everything else that goes with that. So thank you for your time.
Mr. Thaden, you have the last word.
My name is Gary Thaden. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association. The contractors that I represent hire the plumbers and pipe fitters in Carl's Union, and I want to reiterate what all three of my friends in labor said.
You're the big prize winner for concise testimony, Mr. Staten. Finally, Representative Hackbarth had a question, and then we do really need to get out of the room.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't really have a question, but I know that this was an informational hearing, and I think we heard a lot of good testimony against the bill. And I would make a motion, Mr. Chairman, that we would vote on this bill and send it to the general legislature. and I request a roll call.
And, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Representative Eakin.
Oh, well, and, I would speak against the motion and believe that this is still a work in progress, that we want to do more work on. I think there's a number of issues that still need to be addressed, so I would speak in opposition to the motion. And Mr. Chair,
Representative Eakin,
I would like to make another motion to adjourn.
Well, Representative Eakin, that is a higher motion, so we would have to vote on that one first, and that would be a non-debatable motion, I assume. All those in favor,
Mr. Chair, I'll ask for a roll call on the motion to adjourn.
Very good, Representative McNamara asked for a roll call on the motion to adjourn. And all right, the clerk will call the roll. The chair votes aye to adjourn.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Bigham?
Aye.
Representative Cornish? Representative Bill?
No.
Representative Draskowski?
No.
Representative Eakin?
Aye.
Representative Fultz? Representative Hackbar?
No.
Representative Hansen? Representative Junkie? Representative Loon?
No.
Representative McNamara?
No.
Representative Purcell? Representative Saylor?
Yes.
Representative Sterner?
Yes.
Representative Thiessen? Representative Wagenian?
I have 5-6, so the motion does not prevail. We'd move on to Representative Hackbarth's motion. But, let's see. Yeah. I mean, sorry, we're out of time to do this kind of thing, so I'm just going to call a recess to call of the chair.